don't just produce a single ad, produce three or four ads that are all related to each other in a campaign. Mm-hmm. Because you get that familiarity, you get that consistency, you get that storytelling narrative that spans a single spot and starts to reach across the entire campaign, and it's consistent across touch points. But then when it comes to the sound, they don't apply exactly the same rationality. And it's just because we haven't had the data that supports it. But now that we do, we can push it into the marketplace and hopefully start to support a very different decision-making process when it comes to sound in branding or sound in advertising.
Welcome to Audio Branding, the hidden gem of marketing. Sound plays a more important role in human behavior and our decision-making than you may realize. In this podcast, I'll help you understand the art and science of sound so you can better influence others in business and your life. I'm your host, Jody Krangle. Let's delve a little deeper. Here's the second part of my conversation with Joe Sauer.
I love that human beings can tell when they're talking to another human
right?
being. That just blows my mind. Yeah. I mean, sound is so powerful. It's just it's absolutely super powerful, and especially when it comes to decision making. So it sounds like what you've found is that people are influenced definitely by sound in making decisions.
They are. We've done various studies where we quantify the impact on decision making of sounds versus visuals, whether it's a static visual image or a moving image like a movie or a music video or a TV ad or an Instagram ad mm-hmm. or whatever. And we found that the music, typically the audio portion, I should say, typically accounts for somewhere between 45 and 65% of the influence on decision making. And so when you think about it, the audio budget for Hollywood movies is somewhere between 5 and 10% of the total production budget.
Yeah.
And that includes all the marketing and distribution, like the cost of producing a movie. The mm-hmm. audio portion is somewhere between 5 and 10%. Take a wild guess what the proportion is for advertising. How much of advertising production budgets on average are spent on the audio portion of that ad?
On the advertising budget, and
yeah.
I mean the advertising budget itself might be pretty huge, but the audio portion's always pretty small.
Less than 4% on average.
Oh my goodness,
so
that hurt me to hear.
If you think about storytelling, if we say you know, other than books, what is the most powerful storytelling medium that mm-hmm. you've ever experienced? Most people will say a movie. Right. And so if movies are these powerful emotion ringing, you know, experiences that we have, and they're spending, let's say, an average of about 8% on the audio component of creating that incredibly powerful story, advertisers are supposedly doing the same thing, right? They're mm-hmm. engaged in narrative-based storytelling. They're trying to trigger emotional responses. They're trying to embed in long-term memory. They're trying to activate associations. If they're spending less than half of what movie makers are spending, and they're still generating audio tracks that are influencing behavior, imagine what they could do if they simply ratcheted that up a percent or two.
That is so true.
The opportunities are limitless. And yet, you know, as we've experienced, the audio decisions are typically made at the end of the process without a whole lot of forethought. And in a time-pressured environment, they're typically made in a much shorter time frame than we'd like to see, than would allow that kind of contemplative, purposeful process.
Yeah, very much so. And it's been a huge disappointment for me as well in my entire career. I mean, I've been doing voiceovers for 17 years. Mm-hmm. You'd think it would become at some point not the last thing people think about.
It is. You know, apart from radio, which is, you know, radio is really behind the creation of the jingle. You know,
yes.
It's a kind of a medium length audio asset or sonic asset.
Mm-hmm.
But all other advertising really originated with visuals, right? Back in the Mad Men era, you know, what were they creating? They were creating ads for magazines, you know, for billboards, or what the trade calls out of home advertising. They were creating, you know, TV ads, but really focused on the visual element. And so when you have an entire industry that's kind of grown up and processes that are built or have been built around visual media, it's no surprise that there is really poor understanding of the impact of audio. There is, you know, audio as a whole, particularly in a mercantile context, is under-researched, where if anything, visual imagery is over-researched. And so, you know, combine a lack of understanding with a lack of available data, and it's no surprise the industry got there, and so, or got where we are. And mm-hmm. so, you know, what I'm doing, I guess, is evangelizing, you know, one meeting at a time, one person at a time, one elevator at a time, about the power of music. And increasingly, I'm not alone. There is a whole cottage industry of folks who are engaged in the audio, sound, music, voice production process that are now kind of, you know, evangelizing in the same way. And so we're getting there. You know, we're starting to see the adoption of sonic logos start to peak or push beyond about 10% of major corporations. And you have some industries where, you know, fear of losing a competitive edge, if nothing else, has meant that all of the major competitors in an industry vertical have a sonic logo, or the vast majority of them. So,
The insurance industry. Yeah. Oh my goodness.
Automotive. Yeah.
There's, yes. Yeah. You
know, I think there's lots of evidence. It's contagious. When somebody does it, that FOMO, that fear of missing out, causes a lot of brand execs to stand up and take notice. And so it's happening. And I think the next paths of proliferation, if you will, of sonic branding are extending beyond the core sonic logo into more of a sonic identity framework. So extending into channel specific or seasonal variations of the sonic logo, starting to develop a library of UX, UI, or experience sounds intrinsic to the product itself, or the experience of interacting with a particular company or particular brand. So lots of paths to growth, and I'm encouraged by the signs that that things are still building.
Yeah, I mean, I started this podcast 5 years ago, and I have definitely heard a lot more from people working in audio branding and sonic branding in the last couple of years specifically than in any of the years when I started. It was an uphill battle when I started this. Finding people who were actually doing this was hard. It was harder than it should have been. And now it's not quite so hard, which is nice to hear. It's nice to see. But have you worked on any particular audio brands yourself? Do you do that at all? Or
absolutely, yeah.
You do. Are there any you're particularly proud of that you want to talk about?
There are.
I'd love to hear about them. I'm always interested in the perspective of how they came about and how the company receives them, because often it's all about the company actually using it. And do they use it?
It is. Well, you know, ironically, what we found, or maybe not ironically, what we found is when there's research data to support the consumer response to the logo, there is a much higher percentage or much higher likelihood that the logo will actually be used, and not just used, but used in a brand aligned way, meaning, you know, your Latin American research agency is using it in exactly the prescribed way that we've developed it, not, you know, doing a mariachi version, or, you know, doing some sort of, you know, your Indian agency is producing a raga version, but is actually, first and foremost, being used, but also being used in a compliant way, you know, adherence to global brand standards. And so I think the logos I've researched the most and that I'm proud of are logos where we've either overcome a lot of internal resistance to adoption, or where we've used the logo, modifications to the logo, to actually reposition a company into a new vertical or into new brand territories. And so I'll take the poster child, if you will, of AT&T.
Okay.
AT&T had that, you know, you can probably hear it in your own mind, that iconic kind of four-note logo. It was the original logo, and all of AT&T's sonic work was developed by a New York-based studio named Made Music Studio. Mm-hmm. And AT&T has been undergoing brand repositioning for some time. If you think about the old AT&T, you know, Ma Bell, it was really a telecom utility and generated far more revenue on the business side, you know, big companies with their phone systems, than it did on the residential side, particularly as long distance revenues started to wane. You know, we used to have to pay to make a call to the next city over. Now, you know, we can make calls from one coast to another and they're free. Mm-hmm. But, you know, back in those days, AT&T was really positioned deliberately as a conservative, reliable, you know, not all that interesting, but, you know, super reliable utility service with a very business focus. You know, think of a business person, suit and tie.
Sure.
As things evolved in their competitive landscape, they really wanted to push into more consumer entertainment. And if you think about consumer entertainment, that's kind of orthogonally different from, you know, a button down, you know, suit and tie business person type of positioning.
Very much so, yeah.
And so they made all the updates that they could to the visual identity, the logo, the globe logo and everything. And it just wasn't getting them there. They really couldn't shake the original brand positioning that they had invested so many billions of dollars across, you know, 20 years to develop. And so they turned to the Sonic logo, and they didn't want to lose all of the memory encoding of that, the original Sonic logo, that, you know, four note melody, but they wanted to do something with the execution, the pitch, the timbre, the instrumentation, the duration, whatever it was. They wanted to do something to that logo that would actually start to push the associations of AT&T into more of that consumer and entertainment space. And so we worked for quite a while with the AT&T and MADE team with multiple rounds of research to actually develop variations that were more appropriate for that kind of consumer entertainment side of things, that positioning and all of the brand attributes that ladder up to that, as opposed to, you know, super reliable utility.
Hi, it's Christoph Trapp. Jody's podcast has really been a fantastic resource for me. I listen to it every week when it comes out. I always learn something new. Audio branding is really not something that was always top of mind for me, even though I spent my day creating content of all kinds of different types. So, fantastic show, would highly recommend it. Jody is definitely an expert in the field.
And so over the course of, you know, what felt like decades, but was really, you know, several months, we accomplished the task. We were able to reposition that brand effectively through sound without losing any of the recognizability or memorability, durable memorability of the AT&T identity. And that, you know, is just the type of project. There have been dozens like that, but the type of project that I really am most proud of, because without not just research data, but the kind of implicit research data that really gets at emotional response, we wouldn't have been able to do that. It, you know, it would have been take a swing, roll it out into the market, and then we'll see if we get there.
Sure.
This was able to really prove that we got it right before they invested, you know, however much their media spend is in a given year.
Yeah, I love that. I mean, it sounds really fascinating to me too. Are there any others that you did that you want to talk about or that you're really happy with?
One of the things that we've learned through doing this type of research is the extent to which familiarity particularly with sound, but it extends to all forms of sensory input. But familiarity really does lift emotional appeal. So if I'm comfortable with something, if I've heard it before, and it's pleasing, then that the sheer fact of being familiar with it increases the emotional appeal. And so we often see newly developed sonic logos that don't test as well as a sonic logo that's been in the market for 3 or 4 or 5 years. Everybody wants to hit the gold standard research of MasterCard or McDonald's or, you know, some of these really iconic logos. And the fact is that regardless of their you know, musical brilliance, they've had the benefit of billions of dollars of media spend behind them. And in fact, when the McDonald's sonic logo, the ba-da-ba-ba-ba, when it first came out, it tested really badly using traditional research techniques. And the executive team overrode that. And it's now, as I said, become, you know, one of the most iconic sonic brands in the history of the world. And so everybody wants to hit that level of, you know, baked in, very familiar, and virgin logos that don't have the benefit of that exposure through media just can't compete with that. And so when you start to tinker around in the eyes of the consumer with a well-loved brand, you do it at your own peril.
Yes.
And so one of the brands that is well-loved, at least in the mind of the American consumer, is NPR. It is a national treasure, and their most popular program is their morning show. And it didn't have a sonic logo at all. And yet in a similar way that I described earlier with AT&T, they wanted to try to position this radio program as appealing to a younger generation. They didn't want to alienate the older generation that were used to dial-based radio, but they wanted to really try to get be as welcoming, as interesting, as attention-grabbing amongst a generation that wouldn't know how to use a knob-based radio. You know, it's streaming like everything else. And so they turned to audio as the principal way that they could do that. And we developed, again, with Made Music Studio, the New York-based studio, we developed and researched a whole range of alternatives. And we landed on one that, on an explicit basis, all of the logos that we developed and tested, on a conscious or explicit basis, people hated. They said, you know, I love NPR. It doesn't need music. Music doesn't change my opinion of the brand or of the show or of the talent. You know, don't tinker with it. And in fact, when the winning logo was rolled out, it got the same reaction in the press. What's going on? This is
really? You know,
why are you playing around with this? Blah, 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 blah. And so all of our research, we had to rely on the research data. And the research data showed that of the alternatives that we tested, there was one clear winner. And we rolled it out, implemented it. It's still being used today. And within 6 months, not only were people saying, you know, how much they loved it, how much, you know, it was that conscious response had turned to positive once people got familiar with it, but it accomplished the behavioral outcome that we were hoping, which was their demographic started to broaden and they started to get regular listenership from a younger demographic. And so the gratifying part there was once people, the same writers and journalists that wrote such scathing things about the Sonic logo when it was rolled out were the same ones that kind of issued a mea culpa 6 months later when it became wildly popular. And again, without the right kind of research methodology and data generated from that methodology, the insights gleaned, we would never have made that decision. We would have, you know, scrapped everything and said, this doesn't need to change. We can't improve on this this icon of radio journalism in the U.S.
That makes so much sense. Yeah. And it's a really fascinating study, too. But along those lines, I kind of want to ask you about something, because I've had this conversation with a few people on this podcast. And part of the things that you mentioned that people get attached to something that they are familiar with. And one of the things that has bothered me a lot is that major brands are switching their voice talent every campaign. Mm-hmm. Every campaign, sometimes even within a campaign. And it just, I wondered how much damage that is doing to the familiarity and the way that people feel about a brand.
Yeah, it's huge.
Switching it all the time.
Yeah. They may not actually be damaging the brand itself, the equity that's built up in the brand, but they're certainly missing an opportunity to maximize the behavioral impact of their advertising. And whether it's voice in that example or a Sonic logo, what they do as they build familiarity, as they embed in long-term memory, they build that equity, that consistency in the brand, so that the brand at every touch point, whether it's an Instagram ad, a YouTube ad, a TV ad, a radio ad, the consistency is lifting that familiarity, and that familiarity is leading to an increase in brand appeal on an emotional level. And as I mentioned, that brand is the gateway to influencing behavior, or sorry, emotion is the gateway to influencing behavior. And so brands that don't do that shift it up all the time, either because it's a new brief or a new agency or, you know, a new campaign.
Someone took over the campaign and new agency. Yeah.
It's just it's a massive opportunity that's being let go of. And, the industry, the advertising industry knows better because they push campaigns, right? Don't just produce a single ad, produce three or four ads that are all related to each other in a campaign, because you get that familiarity, you get that consistency, you get that storytelling narrative that spans a single spot and starts to reach across the entire campaign, and it's consistent across touch points. But then when it comes to the sound, they don't apply exactly the same rationality. And it's just because we haven't had the data that supports it. But now that we do, we can push it into the marketplace and hopefully start to support a very different decision-making process when it comes to sound in branding or sound in advertising.
Thanks for taking the time to listen. Quick question. Do you know anyone else who could benefit from hearing more about how powerful sound can be? If so, would you mind sharing this podcast with them? It would mean so much to me. Now, I'll stop interrupting and let you get back to the show.
Yeah, I very much am hoping that people will listen to this podcast and listen to and watch and like read more of what you're putting out there.
Absolutely.
Because I've been following you on LinkedIn for a while too, and I love what you're saying on there as well. So yeah, it's the data that needs to get out there, definitely. Yeah. Speaking of that though, I'm curious also about COVID, because that period kind of changed things as well. What kind of an impact do you think that had on audio branding?
It didn't have enough of an impact. So during COVID, we've been in field researching behavioral response to Sonic logos for about 10 years. And obviously COVID fell in heavily in that period. And so we tend to test the same logos and track the impact over time. That's what gives us the data to talk about familiarity and, the benefit of media spend boosting emotional appeal. We can actually see time series, longitudinal results, and watch that process unfold. What we saw in COVID was a unique phenomenon that was essentially a dampening of the national mood. things felt more serious. You know, trivial decisions started to take on a heightened sense of importance. Mm-hmm. We became much more aware of the consequences of both individual and group actions. And things just felt a lot heavier. And there was a pundit who actually published a list, a video of the music for all of the ads that stayed on air or were created and aired during the COVID period. And they were all mournful. They were all kind of reflecting that mood. They were slow piano music in minor keys.
I remember those. Yes.
Yeah, they were absolutely terrible because what they were doing was actually reminding us of how unpleasant and dire our situation was. They were actually triggering a negative response, and those negative responses attached to the brands that were being advertised while we were having this response. And so there were two examples where companies really understood the impact of sound in their advertising, and they were both used sonic logos, variations on their sonic logo, to really achieve the kind of contextually appropriate impact. McDonald's, if you think about it, the antidote from a sonic point perspective is not to take this negative mood, that, you know, global downturn, and actually play fun, happy music. Mm. But by the same token, you don't want to play this mournful, you know, dirge, elegiac music either. Yeah. So the solution sonically actually was in acknowledging the mood, but providing an antidote to the mood that was contextually appropriate, not effusively happy, because that just wasn't appropriate. And so McDonald's was out way out in front of this. And if you think about their logo, it's very bouncy, right? Very happy. You know, and a lot of their variations, again, whether it was for specific channels or specific seasons or, you know, whatever, really leaned into that bouncy, joyful, happy, carefree, insouciant type of feeling. They actually hired Brian Cox, who is, you know, one of the most brilliant actors working today. He was the patriarch on Succession, you know, the grizzled old guy.
Yes.
I think his Irish background. He produced a mouthed over, a voice rendition of the Sonic logo that was, it kept a lot of the happiness of the Sonic logo, but without the carefree sense. And it came across as ba-da-ba-ba-ba in a way that only Brian Cox can do.
Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
And it was an absolute smash hit. We actually tested at 3 points during COVID, kind of the buildup, the worst of the lockdown, and then the relaxing of some of the constraints. We tested McDonald's ads with the bouncy original logo and the Brian Cox version, and the Brian Cox version consistently outperformed the bouncy original version by a huge margin. Like, it wasn't even close. And so that's a case where we're producing a variation that isn't necessarily seasonal or channel specific, but it's acknowledging that something's going on in culture, not just in health, but something's going on in culture. Preserves all the equity we've built up, but is contextually more appropriate. The other Sonic logo that really did well was the Alzheimer's Association. Nobody wants to think about Alzheimer's, right? It just produces a negative emotional response, and it's not even a subconscious response, right? Like, that one is powerful enough that we become consciously aware that, you know, don't want to think about it. We don't want to hear about it. We don't want to talk about it. And yet, Alzheimer's Association has to advertise. That's their principal mode of influencing fundraising, their principal mode of influencing the direction of research, their principal mode of influencing advocacy in the public space. Mm-hmm. And so they do a lot of advertising, and they, during COVID, they didn't produce a variation of their Sonic logo per se for the COVID period, but their logo was developed with an empathy and a caring of the root in their industry, right? And so it was automatically a good fit for a period where the general mood declined because it had already been developed with that sense of there's something you don't really want to think about, but we're going to push it into your, at least into your subconscious. So because of the pedigree and the history of the development of their logo, what that logo was, the brief that the logo was developed against, made it perfectly appropriate for this doom and gloomy period of COVID. And so what we saw was not only did emotional response to their advertising and to the emotional appeal of the Alzheimer's Association as a company, as a brand, but we also saw a massive uptick in their donations over that period. And so it had, again, a clear link to behavioral response. The visual portion of their advertising hadn't changed, but the presence of this contextually appropriate, brand-aligned logo, audio logo that was very prominently featured in their advertising, produced the kind of behavioral change that they were hoping for. And so those are some examples where you've used music in a strategic way, supported by scientifically validated research, to get at an emotional response that is linked to consumer actions.
Do you want to sound your absolute best when you're being interviewed on a podcast or when you're hosting your own show? I have a podcast episode and free downloadable worksheet called Sounding Your Best as a Podcast Guest off of the audiobrandingpodcast.com main page. Just click on the little square graphic to the left of the player displaying my podcast trailer. It gives you some comprehensive suggestions for where to start or for improving the sound you already have, including the type of microphones to consider and why, ideas for soundproofing your recording environment, and suggestions on how to get the best sound when you're being remotely recorded on services like Riverside FM or Squadcast. Don't let bad audio quality hold you back from being the best podcast guest or host you can be. And of course, if you happen to need voiceover for your intro and outro, feel free to get in touch. I'm happy to help. And now, back to the podcast.
That's totally fascinating. I love talking about all this. I could probably talk with you about this for another hour and a half. However, we are coming to the close here. So I want to ask you if there's anything that you're working on now that you can talk about.
Ooh,
that you can talk about is the qualifier there. I understand it could be tricky.
I think what we're really trying to evaluate now is what impact AI will have on the process of doing research. Similar to the way that musicians are terrified of AI-generated music without any human involvement, in the research field, we're also mildly terrified of the prospect of what we call synthetic data, where we actually write up a survey and we field it not with real human beings, but we field it with a series of AI-generated personas who are, synthetic, if you will, generated by AI. And so there's the obvious areas around the process of research where we can use AI very effectively, and it doesn't threaten the fundamental core of the industry, the precepts upon which the industry is built. But this idea of synthetic data really does represent an existential challenge to the entire industry of research. What we found so far, though, is that much the same way with music, when we're focused on isolating and quantifying emotional response, the best AI can do is tell us how music is perceived, not how music is experienced.
Interesting.
And so if you think about something called the tragedy paradox, we often have a positive emotional response listening to sad music, right?
Yeah.
And so that's just as an example where how the music is perceived, i.e. sad, by an AI system is actually not triggering sadness as an emotional response, but actually triggering happiness or relief or, minimizing anxiety. And so as long as that's the case, AI is going to really struggle to tell us how music will be experienced. It It can do a relatively good job at telling us how music is perceived, but because it doesn't actually experience anything itself, we still need human beings, with the right research methods, to be able to isolate and quantify that emotional response. And so we're looking at all sorts of different ways to implement AI on the research side, just as musicians are on the music side. But we still haven't found any substitute that challenges the fundamental precept upon which the industry is built, which is you have to be human to have emotions, and you have to be able to use research techniques that are able to quantify that emotional response. And as long as that doesn't change, then I think we're good. But it's very distracting and time consuming to stay up with the latest and greatest on what's going on, because there are lots of people betting lots of money that it can change research as much as it's changed music.
Yeah. I can see how it would be a challenging time, definitely. But I loved this conversation specifically, if only just to say that human beings are still human beings. And we can quantify that.
We can. Something reassuring about that, isn't it?
Yes, there's something very reassuring about that. Yes. Yeah. Thank you so much, Joe. This has been absolutely fantastic. If people want to get in touch with you, how would they do that?
Joe.Sauer, S-A-U-E-R, at emotisphere.com, emotisphere.com. Or you can find me on LinkedIn at Joe Sauer.
Great. Wonderful. Thank you so much, Joe. This has been a fantastic conversation. Right. I'm really looking forward to sharing it with everyone.
Wonderful.
Well, that's the end of this episode. Thanks for listening. And if you like what you heard, why not tell a friend about this podcast? It's available in all the usual locations. Until next time.